memory, and war, end of quote. Niam is going to speak about this project, Twice Upon a Time, and her collaboration with 12-year-old Halil, but she is also going to discuss the long-lasting effects of war on children with us this evening. Niam Itani is a young and talented Lebanese filmmaker who already has an impressive list of film credits under her belt. Her short film, Superfool, has screened at festivals around the world. She worked for Al Jazeera Channel in Qatar as a programs producer. She also co-founded Placeless Film LLC, a film production company in Beirut, Lebanon, and also launched Script Experts, a specialized story and script service catering primarily to writers and filmmakers in the Middle East. Well, it is my great pleasure to welcome you, Niam Itani, to Bread and Roses.
Thank you, Delphine. It's also my pleasure to be with you on the show, and I love that it's the longest-running women radio show in the States. That's awesome.
Yeah, that is the longest running feminist show in the nation. I think that should tell you a lot about KBOO and about Portland, Oregon. Thank you for being with us. And I would like for you to start by telling us a little bit about this new film project, Twice Upon a Time.
Well, Twice Upon a Time, like you mentioned, Delphine, is a feature documentary film that I started working on about 3 years ago upon my return to Lebanon from Qatar. Mm-hmm. I had just left my paying job and decided to go on an adventure and make my own independent films. And this is a personal story. So I started to work on the film at a very slow pace, at my own luxury. But in 2012, when the refugees started pouring in from Syria to Lebanon, the story kind of changed, and I became friends with Khalil, and the focus of the whole film changed. It became more comprehensive than a personal film, and at the same time, it included also more personal stuff.
Mm-hmm. And so can you talk a little bit about how you met Halil and why did you guys feel compelled to work together on this film? And how did you come to the idea of telling your parallel stories?
Yes. In 2010, my plan was to interview family members and get to know from them about memories that I had forgotten during my childhood in the Lebanese Civil War, which started in 1975, before I was born, and ended in 1990. So 9 years of my childhood were during the Civil War. And when I returned to Lebanon in 2010, I had forgotten most of those first 9 years of my childhood. And you can say that I only had the traumatic memories only were left. So I decided to interview family members and search in our family archive of photos to find nice memories during the war. This was the original idea of the film.
Mm-hmm.
In 2012, the situation in Syria got worse and refugees were coming in. So we had an extra empty family house in Ghazni, the village where we took refuge in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
So my mom said we will offer this house for a family of refugees if they need it, because we are not using it right now. And that is how Khalil and his family came and took refuge at our property. So that is how we met. Mm-hmm. And slowly, as I was seeing how they are living their daily life and what they are struggling with and all that, I discovered that instead of looking for memories from my own childhood, maybe I can film this young boy, because he is kind of reliving a similar childhood to the one I had, and use it to reflect on these memories. So my plan was to look for nice memories in Beirut. What I ended up filming was nice and sometimes sad moments in Gaza, which for me is was the haven of safety and peace when I was a child.
And can you tell us how old is Halil and how old you are and what is your collaboration like? seen, you know, some excerpts of, you know, your interactions together, and you seem, you know, really loving to each other. I'm just curious.
Yes, Khalil today is 12 years old. He became 12 on September 22nd this year, 2013. And I just completed 33 years old in November of this year. So there is 21 years of difference between us. We are excellent friends. Sometimes I am like a mentor for him. Sometimes we are just friends. He buys me ice cream. I drive him around. We play soccer together. We fly the kites. So when we were filming, slowly he started to become more courageous and to help me sometimes to set up the tripod. Then I gave him a small video camera, and he started to film when I was traveling away, for example, for projects or film festivals. And he also filmed, like, he has more access to things inside their house that maybe when I am around will not be the same. So he filmed his own 3 hours of rushes for the film, while I have, of course, a lot of other footage. But, so he's basically also making the film with me.
Mm-hmm. And so I think at this point you have most of the footage that you need, but you are looking to raise funds in order to put the film together. Would you like to tell us, I know you have an Indiegogo campaign, if you have a link to that you can share with the audience?
Yes, we finished the filming process, basically, because I completed filming during Eid, after Ramadan, which is a time of celebration for Muslims. And then we needed to raise funds in order to perform the editing montage of the film. So we started the Indiegogo campaign in order to spread the word about the film and also to raise funds. So it was a dual purpose from the campaign. We found a lot of support on Indiegogo, and it also gave us a chance to show it to people who are in the film industry and in some TV stations in the Middle East who showed interest. So hopefully we will also get their support in order to be able to complete the film. The campaign on Indiegogo is now completed, but of course the page is still up. It's very easy to find the link. It's just Twice Upon a Time, and you should be there.
And people can still donate through that Indiegogo campaign, right?
The people can still contact us or do contributions through PayPal or
So Indiegogo, and then just search for Twice Upon a Time. So, you know, I feel that place is such an important part of this project. I just would love for you if you could locate the Lebanese Republic for the listeners who might not really be familiar with the geography of the Middle East. And then also, where is Syria compared to the Lebanese Republic?
So Lebanon and Syria are both on the east coast of the Mediterranean Sea, which is a body of water between Europe and Africa. On the east coast is Asia, and that is Lebanon basically occupies the east coast of the Mediterranean. Syria surrounds Lebanon, kind of like engulfing us from the north and from the east. So it is surrounding Lebanon. Lebanon used to be part of the greater Syria in old times before all the borders and the maps were created.
Thanks for sharing that piece of history and geography. I just had no idea. Place plays a big part, but also time, obviously. And you spoke about the civil war in Lebanon starting in 1989. Could you talk about what happened and what made your family leave Beirut and find a refuge in Gaza?
Yes. The Lebanese Civil War actually started in 1975, and it lasted 15 years, but it was multifaceted, and it happened in phases. Sometimes there people will be fighting for 2 years, for example, then there will be a short truce, and then fighting will start again between different factions. So in 1989, the battles restarted. So my family, my parents used to take us away from Beirut every time when the bombings or fighting became worse. We used to escape a lot of times before. But usually it stayed, the situation would be bad for 1 week or a few days, 10 days. And then we would leave Gaza and come back to Beirut in order to go back to school. What happened in 1989 is that the fighting restarted. So we left Beirut to Gaza. We thought that it will be another time where we stay away for 1 week or a few days. But then the 1 week quickly became 2 weeks, then 1 month, 2 months, and we started going to school there. And then we ended up living there for 5 years because the situation at the beginning it didn't become better. And then we basically had started another life in Gaza. So we stayed there.
We are speaking with Niam Etani, who is a Lebanese filmmaker, and she is talking to us about her project, Twice Upon a Time, that tells her story and the story of her childhood and her family moving from Beirut to Gaza, I guess that's how you say it.
Yeah.
Okay, I was saying Ghazi, but yeah, pretty close. And then also in parallel, there is the story of Khalil, who just found also refuge in Ghazi with his family from Syria. I'm sure that a lot of people are aware about the situation in Syria, but can you talk a little bit about how Khalil's family ended up leaving Syria in 2012 and moved to Ghazi?
Yeah. Well, basically, you're asking me to give myself away. I'm just kidding. So Khalil's family comes from Daraa. That is the region in Syria where the revolution started, and consequently, a lot of fighting was happening there. And it is the first place where the situation got quickly bad. So they come from there, but they stayed there as long as they could. I mean, it is the same story. The children go to school, the parents have a house there, you know, the normal life that they have established for years or generations. So at the beginning, nobody thinks of just leaving their property and the family and going. But in 2012, the schools have closed. At that time, when they were, the school was over. They came in July. School was over, so they came. The situation was very bad, and there's shelling and bombing and street fighting. All these problems. So they came to Lebanon. The same story. They thought that they will be coming for a few days. Khalil's mother, actually, who is 2 years older than me, I'm also friends with her. So she said that they came during Ramadan, and she said, we thought that it will be only 2 weeks and we will be going back to celebrate Eid in our house and in our country with the family. But then they ended up staying more time, and school time came, September. So many people that year did not register the children in school because they still had hopes of returning to their country, but she did. This is the positive thing that she did. She said, I don't want my children to miss any day of school. So she registered them in school, and now that was a good thing that she did, because now they are still in Lebanon. The situation in Syria is very bad. Nobody can go back to their houses, and even if they go, again, the schools are closed. So life is more or less impossible for them there. They are forced to stay in Gaza for now. And the kids, Now Khalil is going to school for the second year. Things will slowly they will get used to the situation. Things will get better for them, for lack of another.
I think that, I'm looking forward to continuing this conversation because I think what is so fascinating is how your stories have happened in parallel. And I'm sure there's so many other stories that are just similar to both of you guys's. But I also think, that I'm really looking forward to the part of the conversation when we talk about the effects of war. So we're going to take a short musical break. You're listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO. And I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and I'm talking to Niam Itani, who is a Lebanese filmmaker. She's on the phone from California. And the documentary film project that she is working on is Twice Upon a Time, telling parallel story of her and her family in 89 leaving Beirut and going to Hazi, and the story of Khalil and his family leaving Syria in 2012 and also going to Hazi. We are going to take a short musical break, so stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute. Listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and on the phone from California, we have Niam Itani. She is a Lebanese filmmaker, and she is talking with us tonight about her project, a documentary film project called Twice Upon a Time, and that's her collaboration with 12-year-old Khalil, and this beautiful film is going to be telling both of their stories kind of in parallel, about 24 years apart, in this village, small village in Lebanon, called Hazi. And the film is in the making, so if you would like to learn more about it, you can go to Indiegogo, and I'm assuming it's .org, but maybe it's .com. And looking for Twice Upon a Time, and really seeing how beautiful this project is going to be, and potentially contributing if you are interested in helping Niam and Khalil get this off the ground. Niam, before the break, you explained to us the civil war in Beirut when you were young, and the situation in Syria right now, which made both of you, Khalil and Khalil's family and your family, move to Hazi. I was wondering if you can talk about this place, this village, describe it to us, and maybe tell us a little bit about how it felt to you when you were a child and we're living there.
Yeah, sure. Hazi is now bigger than a small village, but it's still a village in the countryside in Lebanon. When we took refuge there in the 1980s, it was only a few houses, and as a child living there for 5 years, I got to know more or less all the people in the village. But today it has become a big town, and there are a lot of villagers, and there are also a lot of Syrian refugees, sadly. There is probably nothing really special about it, except that it is the place where I grew up in. It's in the middle of a valley, very fertile land, agricultural land in the middle of Lebanon, closer to the Syrian border, so it's in East Lebanon. On both sides of the valley, there are mountain chains, so the sun rises from behind the mountains and sets behind the mountains also. I like it, simply because it was the best time of my childhood, I hope that it will also be a good time for Khalil as he grows up. When I came there, I was 8 years old. He came when he was 10. So I hope that he will be able to forget most of the unpleasant things that happened in Syria and remember the good times that he will hopefully be able to have in Gaza.
Do you know why your family decided to go there? Was there any attachment to that place prior?
There was not really a specific attachment to the place, but one of my father's friends was from Gaza, from the village, during university. He was his best friend. So, and it is far from Beirut, so it was far from danger. So that was what made them choose it, or it just happened that they knew somebody in this village.
I'm really curious to hear from you about the impact that the civil war has from you when you were a child, and how difficult it was, you know, leaving your familiar environment, you know, so suddenly, and having to go to a place and ended up staying there.
At the beginning, I think the first tough things for a child is to leave the environment where they grew up, like to leave our house and our toys and stories and our school and friends and leave, because as children we are unable to appreciate the fact that the parents are taking us to a safe place, because we don't understand danger. I remember when we were when I was a kid, I remember that when the older people, like my uncles or aunts, used to say, we can see the bombs flying outside, because you don't know, you are a child, we used to hurry to the balcony and look for them. Where are the bombs? Where are the bombs? So as a child, you don't understand that this might kill you, unless, God forbid, you actually see it happening to somebody in front of you. So leaving a familiar place first deprives you of the comfort of the place where you grew up and all your personal belongings, your friends, the family around you, extended family, and all that. You have to go to a new environment. In the village, particularly, coming from the city, village kids are different. So we were like the, you know, we were different than them. We didn't grow up in the same environment, so we were strangers in the village. At school, we were strangers. At home, we had to discover new things to spend our time and to play with. So life changes. And after a few years, when the situation got better in Beirut, and we eventually have to go back, when we went back, I was 13. So the same problem will happen. And I think for Khalil, unfortunately, but I hope that they are able to return to Syria, everything will have changed when they go back. He will not be with the same friends. He might not be able to go back to the same school. Their home will probably change. So this, for me personally, for example, after two times moving and changing environments, being forced to do that, I think that unconsciously you start to feel detached. Like you don't want to make new friends because you feel that the friends will be lost. Or you don't want to love the new place because you know that any day you might have to leave. So I think for children it had that effect.
And how about when you went back to Beirut, was your house still there? Did you have to move into a very different place? What was that like?
When we went back to Beirut, alhamdulillah, our house was okay. I don't remember very well if it was. I think it was damaged, but it was a very minor damage. But there are other difficult things for you when you return afterwards because you have witnessed war in, like, for example, for me, in one specific building in Beirut. So when I go to the building where our previous house now, but when we return to the same building. So you relate the building to memories of war, unpleasant memories. And it's not easy to go to school every day and then come back to a place where you were afraid, or where it reminds you of tough times.
Yeah. How about for Khalil? How was that like for him to leave Syria? I think I don't know if you want to call it a trailer of the film, but you have on your Indiegogo campaign a very beautiful summary of you guys' story. And I remember a quote from Khalil's mom, who is saying that he used to be a very different kid when he was in Syria, and he's now more troubled. And very often, whenever he gets really upset, he says, "I just want to go back to Syria." Can you talk about that?
Yes, of course. So Khalil was a very bright kid at school in Syria. He was eligible to move to schools for gifted children in 2012, by the end of 2012, before they came to Lebanon. So the first year he was registered for school in Lebanon, he could have been able to go to a school for the gifted in Syria. Unfortunately, because of them coming to Lebanon in the first place, and then because of them staying, he was unable to attend this school. And second, for him, the whole curriculum changed. In Syria, the school curriculum is all mainly in Arabic. In Lebanon, we study in English or in French as a first language. And then Arabic becomes a second language for children above the age of 10. So he was forced suddenly from becoming one of the children who scores 99% and above to becoming just another average child, and also to have to deal with being a stranger in the village, a Syrian child. among the Lebanese. And the Lebanese people, honestly, it's a sad fact, but most of the time we look down on Syrians. So for him, I think it was very difficult to deal with all these things, let alone the fact that he didn't want to come to Lebanon. He also, I think, doesn't understand. When I interviewed him, he told me that he didn't want to come to Lebanon when his mom and dad took the decision for them to leave. He said, why did we come? Our house was still there. We were okay. But he cannot estimate the dangers that they were, possibly they could have happened any day. So when they came to Gaza, of course, he was rebellious because he didn't approve of them coming. He used to shout a lot. He became more aggressive. In Syria, he was more, he liked the young children. He used to play with them. He used to take care of his sisters and younger brother if the mom needed to go to buy something, let's say. So in Lebanon, he basically, everything changed. His attitude also changed with his mother. He started to talk less, much less with her, and to communicate less about his problems and to try to deal with things on his own. So all this changed for him. Now, the good thing is that after the first year, now they are starting the second year for him at school. So this year, for example, he has friends at school, or at least he knows the children, and the children know him, and they know that he is serious about studying, not just going to school to be at school. So I hope that the second year will be better, and maybe the third year, like for me, when what happened is, I think the third year we lived in Gaza, I started to identify more with the village than with the city. I denounced Beirut altogether. So I became like a villager. If it happens to him, I think he will be fine. And he looks like he's adapting well. That is also the advantage when you are a child. The parents, I think, it's very difficult for them because they will always know what they lost. The children can probably forget easier and adapt easier.
And what do you think him participating with you in making this film, Twice Upon a Time, is also having on his understanding of what is happening to him? And is he able to relate and to hear your story of you know, somewhat success also after experiencing something similar than he is experiencing right now?
I think he did a marvelous job of, first of all, understanding what we have been through. And he told me one time when I asked him, do you know what we are making a film about? He said, we are making a film about you. The Lebanese, he meant. He said, we are making a film about you, about what you have been through during the war and how it is, and how what we are going through is nothing compared to what you have been through.
Oh.
So for me, it was like the opposite, because I'm trying to make a film about him, them, the Syrian children, and maybe helping to prevent the repetition of the same thing that happened to us to happen to them. So he's definitely able to relate. And at the same time, by getting him involved in my film work, and I'm also, he was involved in the editing process. I always keep him updated about the projects and what's happening. I think I try to infuse more hope into him, because I tell him, it's okay if this happening to you today. It also happened to us, but now we are fine. Look what I am doing, and I'm traveling and doing this and that. And he sees also the other, my sisters and brother, and he knows that we have all been there, and he sees where they have become today. And I think all this helps him and gives him hope. And he knows that it's very important now for him to focus on his education. We all stress it, and we all try to help him with his lessons whenever we are there, and tell him that this is the best thing you can do if you want to go somewhere.
Yeah. Did he have any comment at all of French or English before he came to Lebanon?
He had, I think he had little command in English.
Okay.
Because it becomes a second language for them in Syria, maybe in grade 4.
Okay.
Just as language. While in Lebanon, it becomes the language of study. So everything you study in English, except for some minor topics like geography and history, you study in Arabic, and the Arabic language, of course. But math, sciences, biology, physics, chemistry, and English, literature, and all that, we study all this in English in Lebanon. So for him, it was quite tough.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Yeah.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. We're going to take a short musical break. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and we are speaking on the phone with Niam Itani. She is in California right now, but she is a Lebanese filmmaker, and we are talking about her documentary film project that she is working on. It's called Twice Upon a Time, and it's talking about the story of her life and her family's experience having to leave Beirut for a village, Hazi, outside of on the border of Syria when the civil war was going on in the 80s, and then in parallel the story of Khalil, who is a Syrian refugee into Lebanon in that same village of Hazi. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to Bread and Roses, and we try to play Pink Floyd. That was Goodbye Blue Sky. Quality on that CD was not great. And also, I wanted to let you know that the music that we played earlier was from Le Trio Joubran, and that was Massar. You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and I'm speaking on the phone with Niam Itani, and she is a Lebanese filmmaker, and we've been talking about this wonderful film, Twice Upon a Time. I have to tell you, I cannot wait for it to be finished so I can watch the whole thing. I have been just really fascinated by your life, Niam, and also by the life of Khalil. And may I ask you if you can explain a little bit about, you know, the that, you know, maybe the healing virtue of telling your own story, how you've been researching, you know, these happy moments and also the moments of war, and how it has affected you and your family, but also as you are witnessing how it's affecting Khalil. Do you think that there is power in telling your own story?
I think it's a double-edged sword. Because as a filmmaker and as a human being, everybody likes to tell their own story, and they think that their story is the most important story, or the most intense, or the happiest story, or the saddest story. There is always everybody. It's just human nature. I've also taught screenwriting for 2 years at the Lebanese American University in Beirut, and my students used always to like to tell their stories. And, of course, we always tell them that that's wrong and that is not the right way to do things. But as a documentary filmmaker, and it has become I don't want to say it has become a trend, but we've seen a lot of personal documentaries lately, in the past, maybe since 2005. Mm-hmm. It is powerful when you have something of substance to share with the world, as long as you can make it universal, as long as you don't put yourself in the hello, mm-hmm. and make yourself the most important character, or try to glorify yourself. You definitely need a team on mm-hmm. the film, because you can easily get lost in your own story. So you definitely need fresh eyes to be able to look with you, and you definitely need talent to be able to point you in the right direction, in the right way to tell the story, because I know every detail of my story. My audience doesn't know anything about me. They don't know who I am. Mm. So it is important to be able to tell the story for a global audience, and put it in the right context and make it relevant to them. Don't get too involved. Don't get too obsessed about yourself mm-hmm. while you are making the film. It's not about me, and it's not about you. It is about the story. So,
yes.
So it's only the story that matters. It doesn't matter who I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think that there is then the power that, as you say, the universality of the story, so that other people can find themselves in your story and maybe feel, that connection.
Yes, of course. Yeah. And you have to, when you tell the story, I mean, when I tell the story, it is my responsibility to share my vulnerability with the world, which is very difficult for me to do. And I think in this moment, I want to really to thank my mother and Khalil's mother for sharing the stories of, mm-hmm. of Khalil and myself and of their families, for accepting to put it out to yeah. the world. They are really, it's really like being naked in front of the whole world in order to work with us, with me and with Khalil, to try and make the people understand how severe are the effects of war on the children.
Yeah. Niam, why did you decide to become a filmmaker?
I don't know if I decided to become a filmmaker.
It just happened.
It just happened. But I love stories. And because we grew up, I think, during the war, and it was tough times, and it was easier to have access to stories than television and electricity and games and all that. So, and I used to listen a lot to my grandmother and my aunt telling us stories. So I grew up loving stories, listening to them, reading them, and then slowly I started to write them. And then I think in university, I just fell in love with script writing and then making them into films.
And another one of your film that I watched, of course, Twice Upon a Time is going to be a documentary film, but I also uh-huh. watched Superfool, which is a film that is a screenplay that you've written and then turned into, made into this beautiful short film. Can you talk a little bit about Superfool?
Superfool is a short narrative film that I made in Doha, in Qatar, in 2010. I had lived there then for 5 years, and I got to know the city really well. It is one of the richest cities in the world, with the highest income per capita. It's a good place if you want to make money. But it's a city also, it is, when you get to know it very well, it's also full of contrast. There are also some of the poorest people who live there, and by that I mean the workers,
yeah.
who live in very tough conditions. So Superfull is the story of a simple, poor worker who promises to take his wife to a fancy restaurant for dinner for her birthday, and how he tries to save money from the tips that he receives working at a petrol station in order to fulfill the promise for his wife. And yeah, it's a very simple story, and I think what I learned from living in Qatar, I tried to put in that film, and it is basically money does not necessarily make you happy.
Mm-hmm. I think that what was the most surprising for me about the film is the fact that the couple is actually mute and cannot speak. And I'm just assuming also deaf. I thought that it was just really bold as a filmmaker to be making a film that's almost silent. Can you talk about your choice? Was that part of the story that, you know, they will not speak?
That was not initially part of the story. It was my desire to make a film that basically conveys the story through images only, yeah, without dialogue, because I find a big problem in the Arab world with a lot of films that they depend on dialogue. So I wanted to make a film without dialogue. But then I needed to say one line for them, and I couldn't find a way not to get rid of the line. So then I said, maybe we can try sign language. And then I went to my colleague at Al Jazeera at the time and asked him how to say this line in sign language, and he showed me. So I thought, this is very visual and very different. Mm-hmm. So then I thought, what happens if we make them deaf and mute? And so it gave the story a totally different dimension, and I decided to incorporate it.
Mm-hmm. And the only line that is spoken in there is super full.
Correct.
What would be your and I actually would encourage everybody. I believe I watched that super full on YouTube. Is that where it's available? Yeah. So look up super full. There is a period between super and full, and Niamey Tani is the filmmaker. As we are getting ready to wrap up here, I'd love for you to be able to share, you know, what would be your message to young women. You know, this show is really trying to empower women and make sure that we are all aware that there are careers out there that we can all pursue. What would be your message to a young woman who might aspire to be a filmmaker?
I think it is exactly what you said. It is a career. It's not a job. Mm-hmm. They have to think of it as a career and not a job, because it's very difficult to make money in this field if you don't want to please the whole world but not yourself. And passion is the best thing that they can have. So there are a lot of obstacles in this field for men and women, and for women it is even more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So they need a lot of passion, a lot of faith, and a lot of will, because there is a lot of rejection, and if you are not the kind of person who will stand up after each blow and say, I'm going to do it, then this won't be the right field for them.
So when is Twice Upon a Time going to be available? Do you foresee this happening soon? Do you have an idea?
Yes, of course. We are now working on the paper edit, which is basically editing the film on paper. We plan to have it ready in 1 year. So by January 2015, the film should be ready. We hope to have it playing at a few festivals, and then we'll make it available for the people who supported us online. And we also want to use it for action campaigns for children refugees around the world, and to use it in Lebanon and Syria and Jordan and Turkey, particularly where there are Syrian refugees and host communities that can benefit from them, from the story and from the messages of the film, and in a way to raise awareness.
Can you share with people how they can get in touch with you if they would like to either contribute or have further questions for you?
Absolutely. I am all over the internet. I am on Facebook, Twitter. We have also pages for the film, for Twice Upon a Time, and for our company, Placeless Films. So they are more than welcome to get in touch with me or with our people. And I receive copies of these emails most of the time, and I will make sure that every email gets answered. And I love to hear from everyone.
Mm-hmm. So let me just spell your name so that people are sure to find you. Is Niam, N-I-A-M, Itani, I-T-A-N-I. So you are also an entrepreneur. You are the co-founder of Placeless Films and also of Script Experts. What is next for you once Twice Upon a Time is completed?
What is next for me is a feature narrative film called Shadow of a Man. It is also in the same vein of stories. It's about a man who is afraid during the war, and because we live in the Arab world where mostly it is shameful for men to be afraid. So this is the story of a man afraid.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, you are on a roll. There's no stopping you. Thank you so much, Niam Itani, for joining us this evening. It's been just a pleasure to learn more about you and especially about this beautiful film, Twice Upon a Time, that I just can't wait for it to be ready for viewing. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Delphine. It was a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. And thanks to all of you for tuning in to Bread and Roses. We are a collective of women-identified radio activists bringing you feminist news and public affairs every Friday at 6 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Make sure to check us out on the web, kboo.fm/breadandroses. You can listen to past shows, even tonight's shows, podcasted. You can also share show ideas with us if you have some and leave comments. You can find us on Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses. And if you would like to join our collective of women hosts, producers, and engineers, you can contact Ani Haynes. She is KBOO's volunteer manager, and her email is volunteer@kboo.org. Before we go tonight, I wanted to invite you to visit a website from a local nonprofit, roseheaven.org, and check out their 2014 calendars. Rose Heaven helps more than 2,000 women and children each year experiencing abuse, homelessness, hunger, and life challenges. And their calendar is a compilation of work by the people, the women, and the children that they help. They say, quote, many choose to express themselves through art, and this calendar is a celebration of the women and their work, end of quote. So again, roseheaven.org. There is also a phone number if you're interested, 503-248-6364. I want to thank Brooke tonight for engineering the show. I'm going to be back next week for celebrating the end of the year with you, and I will welcome Inanna Jehuti, and we are going to discuss the maternal health of Afro-American women. So make sure to be back next week, and have a great week, everyone. And I'm going to leave you with Nicole Kidman, and this one is dedicated to Niam Itani. That's One Day I'll Fly Away. Have a great evening, everyone.
look for the Boo Wire at KBOO.FM for the latest haps here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue.
What we're going to do is throw a lot of banana peels around Chicago and have the machine stumble.
I had a dream that the only reason the employers were so powerful was that we were weak.
There's this myth that black people did not resist until Watts or until the Black Panther Party. It's just not true.
Tune In, Turn On, and Remember is a monthly special program on the history of KBOO Community Radio, commemorating KBOO's 45th anniversary year. The last installment of this special series will be on December 24th at 6 p.m. And listen online to the full series at kboo.fm/tunein/turnon.
Tune in to KBOO's new KBOO podcast.
This is Michael Eric Dyson when I'm in the Oakland, Berkeley, San Francisco area, and I want to hear the real deal. I listen to Hard Knock Radio with my man Davey D. You heard?
Hi, I'm Margaret Cho, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio on KPFA.
Peace, this is Brother Afrika Bambaataa, godfather of hip-hop culture, and I'm on Hard Knock Radio as they blow your funky mind, sucker.
Peace, love, peace, and light, peace out the revolution.
Afrika Bambaataa notwithstanding, this is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
Station. Y'all, we in the Bay Area, and we putting it down. We're conscious, we have our incense lit, and we got our candles burning, and they don't go out by night.
90.7 FM Portland, 91.9 Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis, 7 p.m.
Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. It is Hard Knock Radio, and we have a very, very special guest in the building with us, somebody who I'd known for a long time when he was making history here in Berkeley at UC Berkeley's campus, when he was running for president of the ASUC and becoming the first person of color to hold that spot down. And for folks who went to Cal, he was one of the foundations for one of the political parties on that campus called CalServe. But he's gone on to do bigger and better things, and he is a guru when it comes to urban education, the author of a couple